thank you for your time and attention. We have our first speaker for the morning breakout session. So I'd like to introduce to you Ruth.
Ruth, thank you. And Stuart, you'll give me a notice at what time?
10 minutes. At
10 minutes, okay. Thank you. Well, I'm delighted to be here, I think, and talking to you about some of the content of my thesis. But the question that I'd really like to address here is, what are the resources from the tradition that enable us to become encouragers to modern seekers toward transforming the world? Now, I'm concerned that we, as Western Christians, have largely lost the presence in our midst of people who are recognised as having the charism of spiritual authority. Such persons, by their very presence, their embodied presence, reveal Christ for others. Key to this loss is, I believe, the loss of a simple practice of contemplative prayer, which with grace is capable of leading seekers into the heart of divine mystery. We need to recover a deep and comprehensive practice, some people call it experience, and I'd like to put that in inverted commas, of contemplation, of the prayer of silence, in order to raise up among us those who are graced by the Spirit to exercise the gift of spiritual authority. So what do I mean when I talk about spiritual authority? Someone with spiritual authority in the tradition is recognised by others as having a deep and intimate connection with the infinite mystery, has the gift of wisdom and discernment, and is characterised by love. That's to say, they embody transformation in their very being. By their very being, they become a transforming presence. Their gifts are recognised by others as able to guide them. This is especially significant in the spiritual direction relationship, where the Christic presence, shining through the spiritual guide, awakens the heart of directees to their own Christic nature. One spiritual mother, Maria Gysi, described a spiritual authority as a mirror through which the seeker learns to see themselves, a clear mirror in which they can perceive their true face, and a mirror they can depend on until they learn to see themselves. For the Christian, of course, the ultimate spiritual authority is Jesus. Jesus is the prime example of spiritual authority because he is definitively united with the infinite mystery of the Godhead. As you are in me, as so I am in you. This is the ground out of which he spoke and acted, and into which he invited us, humankind. May they be one in us, into a Trinitarian dance of love, into the mystery of unitive awareness, through the power of the Holy Spirit. This dance is what leads to the transformation of persons and to the transformation, ultimately then, of the world. So how do we foster this capacity for transformation? How do we recognise and encourage the gift, the charism of spiritual authority? In the tradition of all the qualities that I listed before, all the qualities in a person with the charism of spiritual authority, the gift of contemplation is preeminent. Contemplation being the awareness, I'm using it in the context of the awareness of the presence of God, which is known only by love and not by thought. An awareness that is characterized by an elision of self-consciousness. Essentially, it's a different way of knowing. We can predispose ourselves to contemplation through the kenotic journey of silence and patient waiting, of stillness, but contemplation itself is always a free gift. Deep contemplative encounter in God and the charism of spiritual authority are inextricable. Not all people who know God in contemplative encounter are called to exercise the charism of spiritual authority. But it seems that without contemplation, the charism of spiritual authority does not flourish. Bernard McGinn and other scholars have traced throughout the century the gradual diminishment of contemplation, the relationship between contemplation and spiritual authority. It seems especially that in the loss of a practice of prayer that encouraged contemplation, the church in the West has moved steadily towards the neglect of spiritual authority. In the 1970s, Thomas Keating, the Cistercian abbot, alluded to this when he said, "This is why many Western people turn to Eastern gurus now. They come with two questions. What do I do and how am I going?" The church is in the humbling situation of increasing demand for more adequate personal guidance that includes recognition of the apophatic dimensions, yet having lost out of long neglect, fear, abuse, and misunderstanding much of its oral tradition resources for such guidance. Benedictine monk John Main described the same situation as the blind leading the blind. For both these prophetic figures, the way forward was through a disciplined practice of prayer of the heart, the prayer of silence, the fruits of which they embodied in their own lives. Both Keating and Main bring qualities that I argue need to be more widespread, especially in the community of spiritual directors, those involved in spiritual guidance. In the context of spiritual guidance, those with the charism of spiritual authority would encourage and deepen the transformation for those they are guiding. Like the mirror transparent to Christ of Maria Gisi, they would embody leadership from a place of interior freedom that reflexively frees others into the liberty of love. For example, one Greek abbot recalled a contemporary monk who was saturated and saturating others in the light of Christ. He said he literally overflows. He has a treasure of inexpressible joy hidden in an earthen vessel, small and fragile. And this joy overflows and spreads all around him, filling his surroundings with its fragrance. Light shines from his being. Such gifts exist and cry out to be nurtured. Unfortunately, we are wary of authority generally and spiritual authority in particular in the West today. I surveyed Presence, the international quarterly journal of the Interfaith Spiritual Direction Community, and want to remark on two findings. Firstly, there is little or no understanding that I could see in the articles of spiritual authority. There is awareness of the individual qualities that I spoke of earlier. There's awareness of contemplation, of the importance of discernment, and of the importance of love in relational. But there is, as a constellation, understanding that the director may also be the message is not reflected in the articles within the journal. There is instead a growing trend towards a more horizontal mode of spiritual companionship. And some of this is understandable in the context of the damage hierarchies can do. However, the desire of Jesus that we may become one with the Trinitarian Christ, with all its implications for authority, still stands. Secondly, while contemplation is regarded as essential in the journal... Oh, okay. Can I have 30 seconds? Thank you. There's a wonderful awareness of the importance of contemplation in the articles in presence. However, there is a very variable understanding as to what that means. Some of that relates to the history and the constitution of the community itself. But I think we need to recover also a rich and more accurate understanding of contemplation and of how to foster the comprehensive daily kenosis that it entails if transformation into Trinitarian dance is to flow with grace. In conclusion, recovering the place of those with the charism of spiritual authority to sit alongside other spiritual guides is important for Western Christianity. It is dependent on a deep but comprehensive practice of contemplative prayer and grace. Then the Western Church may be able to meet the needs of those Christians who hunger for the fulfilment of the words of Jesus in their own lives. May they be one in us. Thank you. Thank you. Now, I didn't prepare a question until a few minutes ago. And what I thought, the elephant in the room is to ask you, what is really, how do you perceive spiritual authority in your own lives? How does my version, what I'm saying is in the tradition of spiritual authority in our Western tradition, how does that sit with you?
Maybe if we have a conversation in the table level, so we've got something like 8 minutes, and if you're looking responsive, I may call out some responses to give some feedback to otherwise maybe you can capture a note and maybe share with the table that's behind you. So 8 minutes, please proceed.
I mean,
that's
very good. That's brilliant. That was just beautiful.
Thank you.
Just beautiful.
Thank you, John.
I'd like to ask a question, though.
Yeah, well,
ask a question.
You can ask me. Yeah.
Because, you know, spiritual authority.
Yes.
Our day and age is individualistic.
Yes, I know.
People want to be in charge of their own things.
Yes.
The whole idea then of having someone who has authority.
That's right. That's right. And that's what I want to say to the group. This is what wasn't in, what we didn't put in. But this is what I want to talk about. It's how that the whole notion of authority and personal responsibility for the journey have to sit together. That's what you know. You're a Latin scholar, John. Uctor etatum.
Really?
Uctor etatum. I've forgotten the words, but the Latin roots of authority.
Means growth. It's all to do with growth.
Yes, and it's related also to auger, to increase.
Yeah, adjuration.
So within
the
the very word is authority is meant to increase others. It's meant to, so if you like, yes, that's the nature. But people have a different view of it.
Yes, it means law, doesn't it? Now?
Yes, but it's not the original meaning. So I think if you start talking about you are responsible, and if you go back to Barsanuphius and John, the the old men of Gaza, they said when they were asked about it, I am giving you an opinion. Now you go and do as you may. Now these were deeply, deeply authority figures, profound spiritual guides. So, you know, there's your... I think that's...
I suppose the was lost in the West because of the Dark Ages, the collapse of civilization in the West. And then all these... The need for reforms and the need then to establish laws, institutes. So the monasteries then had to have rules. And so the rule, the abbots no longer functioned as abbots.
Hmm.
The rule was now to be the abbot, was to be what kept the monastery.
But see, John, I think they also lost a practice. They lost a practice. When Lectio Divina gradually got pushed to the fringes, they didn't have a practice which was going to take them to the centre. You know, they started to introduce a lot of subjectivity into prayer. Do you agree with that?
Yes. There was a great loss, and this is one of the reasons why this interest in contemplation, meditation today, which is very wide in society.
Yeah.
Okay, it's mindfulness, but still, that's something. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's a great sign for the future.
Yes, absolutely. It is.
And I think people are realising that mindfulness by itself, I mean, Gary was saying that. Needs to be enhanced and developed by appealing to the traditions of the different religions. I had a second question, though.
Yes, but I'm a bit worried why. I want to hear what people think.
Yes, so
can we hear... Are you going to call for comments? Yes, thank you.
I want to hear. So can I stop you where you are? And can we call for some feedback, please?
Is there a bell?
Hello? Anyone there? Can we have some feedback, please? Ruth would very much like to have some feedback from
I would.
Sharing. So, 3 minutes. So, the first three voices get the floor.
My first question was, can you give us some examples, please, of people you seem to have that
yeah, and well, two of the names I mentioned before, Thomas Keating and John Mayne. Well, John Mayne is one of the people that I'm using in my thesis, and there, what we saw was that constellation of qualities in him as a person of faith, deeply, deeply immersed in the Christ mystery. All the reports of people seeing him as a figure of love. And above all, as a figure of wisdom and someone who could lead them to the end, could take them the whole way. And this is what people are looking for. If you think about people traveling to the... to lose the microphone. Traveling to the east, etc. It's about looking to see who can take us to the depths.
I think to Nomanash, it can vary so much to Nomanash. Like, I have had experience in both Churches of Christ and the Anglican Church. And the Anglican Church, you have people who are raised up, who are given authority, ordination, all this sort of thing. But then in Church of Christ, Baptist Church, generally more low church traditions, I think they're actually a lot more discerning of that spiritual authority, because it's not someone being chosen by, you know, the Archbishop or whatever. It's someone who you're seeing in the church community who is, I see that this person has the ability, has these qualities, has the ability to lead, has the ability to go all the way. And these people are the ones who are typically raised up into those positions.
One of the things that I didn't mention in this, thank you for that comment, is because it relates to the actual way in which a person is recognised as having the character. And recognition is a really important word, because it is the spirit within the seeker who recognises in another person as having the qualities who can lead them in their journey of prayer. Callistus Ware has a wonderful saying about not by the laying on of hands, but by the anointing of the Spirit.
Thank you. I think we did our time, but special thanks to Ruth. So, Christopher, we'll call you forward, sir.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Are you having any... Okay, I'm the same.
No, take some magic.
Well, I think Christopher and I have corresponded by email. It's lovely to meet you in person.
Nice to meet you, Stuart.
Wish you well. And we're looking forward to your presentation today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stuart. And thank you, Ruth, for your gentle authority with which you present. It was beautiful. Well, I come here today. I absorb what comes in, and I can't stand before you today without acknowledging some of the sense of vulnerability that I feel right now with some of the content we've been receiving, and particularly this morning. I was deeply, deeply challenged and touched and crushed by what I felt was quite a prophetic utterance from Gary. And it reminds me in some ways of the subject of my talk, Meister Eckhart. Now, you may or may not be familiar with Eckhart. I've become very familiar with him over the past 7 or 8 years. And you may know that Eckhart, at the end of his life, in fact, he was tried under the Inquisition. He was a Dominican scholar and remarkable preacher and a challenger, and he's often called a mystic. And while I struggle with that term, I can understand what they're saying when they call Eckhart a mystic. But Eckhart was hauled before the Inquisition. He had two trials, one in Cologne. He's a German Dominican from the 14th century. Then one in Avignon under the Pope John the 22nd. He had his teachings, great chunks of his teachings, statements pulled out of them, completely out of context, were condemned as being dangerous and heretical sounding. And Eckhart, once you really get to know him, he has the sense that he knows that he's shocking people and he knows why he's shocking us. And he says some things. For example, he says in one of his more mature sermons from down the track and probably not too many years before his life ended, he said, "I pray to God that I might be rid of God." And he knew very well that that would shock. He probably didn't think it would still be shocking people centuries later. But that kind of, you know, apophatic challenge that comes. And so my paper, and really all I want to do this morning is talk about my paper. I would love to present it to you, but I'd need a little longer. My paper is about something that Eckhart said in one of his earliest, in fact, the earliest we know of his German works. And he talked about the quality of what he called an equal mind. The word equal in Middle High German is gleich, which it's got many, many different words that you can use to translate it into English. It can mean like, it can mean equal to, it can also mean, it's one of the words that can be used for just. In fact, he loves the term justice and talks about the just person in many of his writings. And one thing that Eckhart loves doing is using many different ways of talking about the same thing. And so he has lots of similes. And one of the mistakes we can make in reading him is to become too pedantic and picky about what word is he using there. Because really, he's saying, take any one of those words. You know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, well, don't worry too much. You might find it one day. So Eckhart says in one of this early writing, and I'll just explain very quickly what these writings were. They're called the talks on discernment that he wrote and collected together into a little booklet that becomes probably his most widely distributed writing from the very, very beginning of his career in Dominican as a Dominican superior in the time right at the end of the 13th century. And these talks were taken from the Colatio, or there was a gathering after the evening communal meal in the priory at Erfurt, where he was the superior. And he would sit down like an abbot with his congregation, with his community, and he would talk to them about many of the standard topics that you would get within the monastery. So, you know, about the vows of poverty and all those, and the vow of obedience, all of that. And he would reinterpret them in line with his own radical understanding of life and the world. And so this is where this comes from, the idea of the equal mind. Eckhart said that if we could have a mind that appreciated that there is a sense in which, and that's very important in Eckhart, there's a sense in which there is absolutely no difference between the highest angel and a fly and your soul. Another one of those bombshell shocks. And so what he was saying is that there is a sense in which everything is the same and we're all one. And that comes from, and this is, my paper's quite long, I hope you do read it eventually. But what I do is develop that and that simple idea and show that simple idea of equal-mindedness. And Eckhart says, if it's possible for us to have that, then we would never be out of the presence of God, because everything would be for us God. And how does that work? Well, as I explain on probably page 300, the idea that everything is the same is that the one thing that everything shares, and the scholastics saw lots of things, they're called the transcendentals or the primary determinations, lots of things that all things have in common. And Eckhart really made something of this. The one thing that's higher than everything else, that everything that is has in common, and that's that it is. That's the scholastic idea of being. And I like the idea of isness. So something everything shares that I have in common with a stone is the isness. And the other thing Eckhart wants us to understand, that not only does everything share isness, but that isness is divine. It's divine, it's sacred. And so he says, having an equal mind is realizing that everything that is equal in that sense that it is, and that everything is divine. Therefore, it's greater than it is in itself. So I look at a rock, and he says, I can stumble over a rock, and it can speak to me of God because of the isness in the rock. I was hearing some of that in what Gary said this morning, and it really struck me quite deeply. Eckhart is very famous for having proclaimed what he called a way that is not a way. He had this habit of pushing the boundaries when it came to penitential piety, where wearing a hair shirt and doing all of those penitential things was our way to become closer to God and to advance our union with God. Eckhart says, well, that's all right if you're a beginner and you really need that kind of stuff, but please get over it quickly. Because really, there is no need for a way or a technique or anything. All you need to do is learn how to be quiet enough to disappear within your own consciousness and be present to the isness that is everywhere, but most especially within you. And so the question, of course, okay, well, if we don't have a way in a particular technique or spiritual practice, what in tarnation do we do? And Eckhart says, well, this way is really quite simple, this way that is not a way. He said it's really a being at home, a being at home. Finding that place within our own present experience of the world, it's being here now, is the first thing, presence. It's being aware, which I would call silence, not just physical silence, which some of us enjoy very much, but internal silence. And thirdly, this way without a way is this being at home is also a letting go. And this third aspect of Eckhart is probably his most challenging. You've got me. And I have my question already for everybody. I want some feedback. It's this letting go. He invented words to explain this aspect. You may be aware of this if you know anything about Eckhart. There's this wonderful word, Abgeschiedenheit, which was a pulling together. It was not a word before Eckhart. We had gescheiden and abscheiden. We had those words, but he put it all together in a strange way. And it really, what they've come up with is detachment. It's more like detachment. There's a present continuous sense to it, even though it ends up being a noun. And he said, we've got to cut things off, detach from them. He's not talking about the kind of detachment we think of as equanimity, maintaining your equanimity by distancing yourself from your circumstances. He's not talking about that. He means it's things we've got to get rid of. We've got to make some radical changes and cuts. Got to let certain things go. And I guess my question and what I pose in here and my paper, what things do we need to let go of in this day and age? And I think we need to be challenged as abrasively now as Eckhart challenged his generation then and got into big trouble for it. I wonder what we need to let go. He talked about letting go of our way of thinking, ways of thinking and speaking that fostered the idea of an atomistic, dualistic view of the world. That's what he was talking about. We are all one, he said, and divine. How do we find that? It's not just a matter of sitting and meditating. He talked about being at home. That's having a place where you are, and there's nowhere else to get to because it's all here. So I'll leave that with you. And my question for us is, I wonder if in the context of these couple of days together, you might be able to think of what we might to challenge ourselves with concerning things that need to be let go and moved on from and left as challenging as it may be. And I think it's probably a conversation you might like to have together first, and then we'll come back and I'll see if I can get any response from you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So in the conversations that have been going on, am I right in thinking that your paper will be submitted to Spiritus for
yes.
publication in its second round? So
yes.
If you subscribe to membership in SSES, you will get a copy of the paper. So more incentive for those of us that forgot to pay our dues this year, it's a good time to pay up, to get the paper through Spiritus. Okay, so we've got about six minutes or so for a conversation, and then we'll come back and give some feedback.
Lovely.
At the very end.
Thank you, Stuart. Wonderful. Good. That's lovely. I'm going to call them together. All right. I think we have a couple of moments. And Stuart's told you that I put my paper in to be considered for the journal, and the wonderful opportunity that you have now is to help me. If you have a quick critique or a comment that you make about what we might do today in this world to fulfil detachment or letting go, releasement is one way they've talked about Gelassenheit and Abgeschiedenheit. He invented those words because there wasn't anything there in the tradition that he could use to say powerfully enough, we've just got to ditch these things and find a new way of talking. Eckhart said at one point, he said, you've got to let go of not, because not separates things. You've got to let go of this and that and here and there. You know, little prepositions, harmless little prepositions. Anyway, what do you think we might need to, in our context, deal with? Any ideas?
Well, the context of today, just following up what you said before, and it's probably too specific for your paper, but our, you know, Western idea of ownership is something we need to let go of in terms of country.
Mm-hmm.
Understand what country means in this country.
Thank you.
If I may follow up on that, in the US, the term that's being used as something to be let go of is whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. It's an artificial construct.
Yes. And notice how these words are all those things that divide and bifurcate and cause polarization. Exactly. Thank you for that. Anything else at all?
It seems to me as if ego always wants to possess and to grasp and to fight for and to defend. So from a farming background in Western Australia, with what Gary just said, I'm quivering with stuff about ownership and possession. Mm. And what all that means. So I'm with you. I'm just about undone.
Yes. Yes. If we don't take it personally, there's something wrong. John.
Just think, we have security here. We have health. We're basically comfortable.
Mm.
So we can afford to give up this idea of detachment. But when people are hungry and try to survive from day to day, talk of detachment, how does that fit in to this idea of detachment?
Yes.
Or are they excluded from the spiritual path because they must find food for this evening's meal?
That is an excellent question, isn't it? Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that in our context, it would be good to let go of the individualistic view of self and world. And I have a question about how did Eckhart think Gelassenheit can be practiced? Is it through contemplative, sort of individual contemplation? Does he offer any ways to, practice it and maintain it?
That's a really good question. I don't think so, no. Except... It sounds like a terrible answer, except that, I'm sorry, I do have to finish, except that in the process of listening to the silence and the deep listening to the silence, if you think of Dariri, but deep listening to silence, but at the same time listening in a new way to our tradition and to metaphor, and I'll leave it there. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This one now, an idea.
What is this one now?
This one, I can't read the critters.
I know,
we
got
anyway.
The staple.
Yeah, and I'm remembering the numbers. It's good if I'm in the right route.
So thanks everyone for coming along. My name's Ian Radvan. I want to give you in 10 minutes hands-on experience, literally, and then in another 10 minutes explaining the meaning of it. So part of my ministry is getting people to be in touch with nature, and in contemplating nature then to feel, even if they can't express it the way we would, the divine. Now, on the table in front of you is a small plate of earth that comes from the Clare Valley. The Clare Valley has many different kinds of soils. It grows beautiful wine. It grows great pasture for our cows. And it grows a lot of wheat and canola. So it's a rich soil. And soil is composed of rocks and minerals, decaying organic matter, and living organisms. Good humus is dark, moist, and rich in nutrients. And when it's mixed with some air and some water in the right balance, then it's the ideal habitat for plants, bacteria, and small animals like insects and worms. So I'm going to ask you to take some soil and put it in your hand and hold it and contemplate it. Now, in case you're wondering how well I wash my hands, I have a bucket of water and a towel, and on your way out you can cleanse your hands if you're concerned. So, yeah, feel it, smell it, look to see if you can identify different elements within it. It's hard to believe that a mere teaspoon of good soil contains up to 4 billion microorganisms. Can you imagine how many there are in a garden or a park? I ask you to keep holding it, if you can, please, for this meditation. So soil is populated by an amazing variety of creatures, ranging from virtually invisible microbes, such as bacteria and fungi, and then to small animals like centipedes and worms, and then, of course, you've got the larger animals that live in the ground, like mammals and snakes and mice. We have too many mice in our property at the moment. Each of these living organisms has a different and important function. Certain microbes can break down the harder material like wood or chemicals like toxins and pesticides. Others perform a similar process on minerals, thereby releasing nutrients for plants. Please take some soil in your hand if you will. Bacteria are responsible for the decomposition of organic matter in soils. They're usually present in the topsoil, the top few inches of the earth, and they play an important role in converting inert forms of nitrogen into ones that can be more readily taken up by plants. Earthworms help in the decomposition of organic matter in the soil. They also improve aeration, water infiltration, and drainage. And in fertile soils, worms can number as many as 2 million per hectare. Energy and nutrients are passed from one group of organisms to another as one feeds on the other. And at the bottom level of this food web is decaying organic matter in the soil that came from plants. Feeding on this organic matter are bacteria, fungi, root-feeding nematodes, and other organisms. And then higher up, you have small insects, arthropods, and larger nematodes. And then above that, you've got the things that eat the insects, like birds and mice. So I'm going to pause again for half a second for you to imagine all this happening in the soil you have before you, all this activity. Soil has six major roles to play in the ecosystem. It serves, obviously, firstly, as a medium for all kinds of plants, grasses, and trees. It provides habitat for larger animals, insects, and microbes and bacteria. Soil absorbs, holds, releases, and purifies most of the fresh water on land. It can modify the atmosphere by absorbing and emitting dust and gases like carbon dioxide, methane, and water vapor. It processes nutrients and elements such as carbon so that they can be provided for living things over and over again. And finally, perhaps the least appreciative of the value, it's a necessary component of our human building projects, roads, railways, and houses, where we move it around as a filler. I'm going to conclude this first part of our contemplation with some words of nature wisdom. Ecclesiastes 12 reminds us of our nature. The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. From the documentary Dirt, William Logan asks us, "How can I stand on the ground every day and not feel its power? How can I live my life stepping on this stuff and not wonder at it?" Ed Begley writes, "I saw all the people hustling early in the morning to go to the factories and the stores and the office buildings to do their job, to get their check. But ultimately, it's not office buildings or jobs that give us our check. It's the soil. The soil is what gives us real income that supports us all." And finally, from Wendell Berry, "It is impossible to contemplate the life of the soil for very long without seeing it as analogous to the life of the spirit." I'll give you another half a minute to contemplate before we move to the second part. You may return the dirt to the plate if you wish to clear your hands. Thank you. And as I said, there's a bucket and water and a cloth there, so if you can wait for 10 minutes and then you can do your hands. So, the connection, what is this to do with the topic of our conference here? Contemplation of nature is one way that we who understand the spirit in nature can draw anybody into it to have that experience, whether they're a Buddhist or Hindu or of no faith at all or lost Christian, by leading an exercise with nature, people can connect with the divine. And we know from very early in the Christian tradition, like St. Paul, that we recognize God in creation. As Paul said in Romans, "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, God's eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse." Can you give me a 2-minute notice when we get close to the end, please? Yeah. The early church fathers, many of you may know, adopted the idea of nature as a book, Librum Naturae, as part of a 2-volume theology in which the second book was the written word of scriptures. They recognized the value of the natural world as it provided a means of perceiving God's work and acquiring reliable knowledge of God. Anthony the Abbot in the 3rd century said, "My book is created nature, which is always at my disposal whenever I want to read God's word." In other words, God had infused the material world with symbolic meaning, which, when understood by a seeker, reveals higher spiritual truths. And I think we heard Gary talk of that way too, that country is revelatory of God. For those who seek a God of providence and love, seekers of all kinds, the one who reveals God's personal love for us is the same as the one who creates and holds all things in existence. Psalm 113. "The Lord rules over all nations. God's glory is above the heavens. There is no one like the Lord our God. God lives in the heights above. But God bends down to see the heavens and the earth. God raises the poor from the dust. God lifts the needy from their misery. Christian spirituality engages in contemplative practice when it opens itself to intentional experiences of nature, and it allows other people who do not associate with the Christian community to join in with them. Here there are no creeds or dogmas to confuse or divide, only concrete experience which people can share. The long, rich tradition of appreciation for the divine in nature and Christianity has been highlighted most recently by Pope Francis in his encyclical Laudato Si. There he calls all people to recognize our intimate connection with earth as our physical mother and the medium, the revelation of God's love. I quote from it, "The entire material universe speaks of God's love, God's boundless affection for us. Soil, water, mountains, everything is, as it were, a caress of God." In this century, we are more than ever aware of the human impact on climate and the large-scale environmental consequences. To appreciate and care for this planet, our common home, is something that can unite all believers and none. We share wonder at a sunset or a breaching whale, sadness and anger at the deliberate destruction of the environment, and a passion to protect what is threatened with extinction. We can all experience gratitude for this amazing planet that not only gives us life, but that by through its beauty and diversity evokes our poetry, our music, our art, and our prayer. A Christian prayer ministry that physically engages with nature allows for the surprise and revelation of the Spirit, since the outcome cannot be predetermined. Every day the weather is different. Animals come and go at their will. Our personal moods are different. A contemplative attitude in a natural environment can evoke unexpected memories or associations that can be insightful, healing, peace-inducing fruits of the Spirit. One such Christian ministry is the Being with God in Nature ministry, which began in Melbourne in the last decade. It was the brainchild of Dr. Peter Saunders, assisted by like-minded Helen Lucas and myself. All of us believe that people can commune with God through nature and that this can become a communal experience if guided rightly. The mission goal of Being with God in Nature is to enable an ecological conversion, which would then form the basis of attitudes and actions more caring of Earth. By taking people out for a contemplative engagement with nature over the course of a day or a week, the hope is that participants would experience their natural environment in a new way, experiencing the presence and action of God, even if they don't use the word or name it. How much time have we got?
A bit more than what you think, but if we go over 2 minutes now,
then we'll do that. Okay, well, in 2 minutes, then I'll explain a little bit how the Being God in Nature works in a practical way, so that you might want to do this in your own place, and then I want to finish with a prayer before anything else. So, the leaders of this ministry do is we identify walks of 2 to 4 hours in nature. They don't have to be far from the city, no more than an hour and a half of travel before the person gets out of the car and says, "Here I am." And obviously we walk it beforehand and we test it. Is it too rigorous for people who want to contemplate rather than struggling with rocks and effort? We want to make sure that the toilets and rest facilities are available. People are invited or asked to bring lunch and snacks. And we take them on a walk. It's not about, I can walk 6 kilometres an hour. It's about what do I notice along the way. So it doesn't have to be a long walk, but we choose those that have some beauty, that evoke wonder and awe. So we gather in the morning. We have a little bit of prayer that opens us up to say, this is a prayer experience we're having. It's not just any walk in the bush with people we know or don't know. So there's a focus on nature. And then what we do is give out slips of paper They may be laminated with wisdom quotes like the ones I gave you for soil from all the traditions where mystics have discovered or scientists the wonder of nature. We give one out to each and they read it, and that's something they contemplate while they're walking in nature. Then we have a 2 hours, 1.5, 2 hours of silent walking, very slowly. There's a leader at the front and a leader at the back to contain people. Then there's a lunch where people may talk if they want to. Then we have another 1.5 to 2 hours. It may be a return trip, but we prefer a loop if possible to take people through a new bit of bush. Then at the end of the day, we gather for sharing, which is listening to each other. So it's the three questions I put to people is, what was your physical experience? How were your senses activated? How did your body respond? Each person responds and there's silence. You just listen. And then the second question, what did you notice arising in your heart or mind? How did that provoke the spirit in you? And again, each person shares if they want to, and then silence. And then thirdly, do you want to respond to anyone else's sharing? And that's where the discussion can open up and take people where it will more freely. So we find that that is very effective. Even on one day, people can discover for the first time, hey, you know, instead of listening to something in my ears or talking with somebody else, I'm listening to nature. That is a new experience for them. And when we take people out for a week, there's genuine movement from, yeah, nature's nice, we've got to look after it for utilitarian reasons, to, I love the trees. We should protect them. There's a relationship builds up. So I'm going to finish with a prayer and then we can open up. So let's, for a moment now, close our eyes and re-feel that connection with the dirt, the earth you had at the beginning. We share the same molecules and atoms. It's only the presenter can get away with that. We are aware of the labor of God in the earth, animating tiny creatures to provide energy for plants. I recognize that my being and my living depends on soil and water and air and all the living creatures of this planet. And I remember that God is present in me, filling me with a desire to understand, to love, and to praise. In the light of this last 20-minute experience, is there any desire that I feel arising in my heart? Thanks be to God. Amen. Thank you. So on your table, some resources to do with contemplation of soil, a diagram just to show how soil works. You don't have to take any of those. And a little promo for the a camp I'm organising at Seven Hill in the Clare Valley for young people to experience what you have in 20 minutes this morning, but over a 6-day period for an ecological conversion. So any responses or feedback?
Yes, we've been offering just a few minutes at the end of each session for responses, either as a question or observations. So to Ruth, Christopher, and to Leah, just a few minutes, maybe one personal observation, address to each.
Say that in the U.S. there is a movement called Wild Church.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrific.
I
You can search that online and find it.
The difference between Wild Church and this ministry, very broadly, is Wild Church takes people's worship outside onto a lawn or under a tree, and they do the whole service there. Ours is not a worship service as such. It's an experience of nature which anybody can participate from any or no tradition. But I do like the idea. If we could be flexible enough to flow with the weather, I'd like to have more of our ritual outdoors for sure. Thanks, David, for raising that. Yes?
Just the design of our buildings.
Mm.
You know, we've got these tiny doors with thick walls. And
yeah.
It's a beautiful day. We're over the roof on the beach.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're stuck inside on a Sunday morning when everyone else
is out. Yeah, and I sort of a way of overcoming that is, okay, you're in a building, that's where people are, they don't like change, we're there. But so I say to people, okay, just think for a moment, stop, you've just been outside, what was the weather like? Feel it again on your skin. Can you hear the waves? Can you hear the birds? Just attune. This is the land we are on, even though we're in a building. And then I proceed with the service. So at least I get people's awareness of nature around them, even if I can't be in it. Yeah.
Whereas at Sunset Rock Uniting, I haven't been there for years, but in the hills there.
Yeah.
See that church, and there's a big window. Mm,
terrific.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah. Catherine.
It's really grounding.
Thank you.
What do you do about nature red in tooth and claw, like the kind of old-fashioned language would be the unredeemed or the... Yes, it's easy to romanticise.
That's right. There are spiders and mosquitoes and flies that people put up with when they're walking in the bush and get sunburned and snakes, yep. Well, if longer time allows, if someone raises that question, I like Brian Swim's approach where he says that the competition is part of the process to come to humans. If there wasn't predatory competition and therefore adaptation, then we wouldn't get to this higher form of life. So somehow that's the life and death, the paschal mystery, happens at every level. And that's what enabled us to appear. That's my answer for myself. I don't know if other people like it, but that's how I explain it to myself. So, yeah, unnecessary unpleasantness.
What about the question or observation?
Yeah.
It's very similar to the forest therapy or forest bathing movement, which, of course, comes from totally outside of Christianity, but it's pretty much the same process, except that they have a little bit more systematic development of it, but it's exactly the same intention of awakening people to the connection.
That's right. Well, maybe Peter Saunders, who I mentioned, got the idea from forest bathing. I'm not quite sure where it came from him, but the three of us were bushwalkers for years and years, and then without out or sea, something clicked that said, this is a faith exercise, not just a physical exercise. Yeah. Thanks very much for being here this morning for me.